Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael, and co-hosting with me today is Phoenix, and it's just the two of us having this conversation today. So, we have three topics to discuss. The first topic is Bola Tinubu's appointment of service chiefs. That's the head of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the overall chief of defense staff. Secondly, we'll discuss President Tinubu's claims in France that the former governor Emefiele ran or contributed to a terrible financial system. And thirdly, we'll discuss President Tinubu's trip to France and the benefits that accrue to Nigeria from the trip. So to the first question, Phoenix, new service chiefs have been appointed for the Air Force. It's Air Vice Marshal Abubakar. For the Army, it's Major General Lagbaja. For the Navy, it's Rear Admiral Ogala. Chief of Defense Staff is Major General Musa. And the Chief of Police is Mr. Egbetokun. Sorry if I've mispronounced the names. So what are your initial thoughts? Is this a sign of good things to come, or are you not excited at all?
Hi, Michael, and good to be on the show again this week. Getting used to it, just being two of us again, but it's fun. Hi, listeners. Thanks for sticking with us. We keep getting your feedback, and absolutely delighted that keeps coming in. I think on the service chiefs issue, it's become the norm now that I'm like, I wonder now how much thought is being put into selecting service chiefs. And the reason why I say this is, what we're finding out is that every time somebody gets sworn in as president anew, they want to change service chiefs. Now, this seems to me like a holdover from when we had military rule. You know, when a coup happens, the new head of state wants to clean house and make sure they're surrounded by people they trust to forestall another coup happen. So, you know, they look at all the beady-eyed military men who are interested in political office and retire them. And then put in some new people. We saw Obasanjo do this when we returned to democracy in 1999, but it was necessary because we had gone through an extended 15-year period of military rule. The military had become exceedingly politicized. The military was so used to having political appointments, having access to the treasury, so you had a whole cadre of people who had risen in the ranks through that kind of system. And so it was necessary for him to properly clean house. But when I look at what has happened subsequently, I'm beginning to think that there's a bigger question. If 24 years after, you know, return to democracy, we haven't been able to sufficiently professionalize the military to the extent that it becomes almost like the civil service, where it should carry on, you know, and not something that still remains politicized in the sense that new head of state comes in, oh, I must change service chiefs. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we shouldn't change service chiefs, especially if we believe that they haven't performed. And we all know that, yes, there's still insecurity across the land. And so there's grounds for that. But when I look at the appointments that have been made, I'm just not sure that that's the driver. So I wait to see where we go with this current set of people. The one thing that struck me as a positive was that, I mean, he tried to balance, you know, by making sure that there was ethnic balance in the choice across the board. But really for me, I'm more worried about this chopping and changing. And to those who are military watchers, they know that once you select someone, a whole swath of experienced, you know, military leaders get retired because you selected someone from the same class as them and things like that. So you lose a lot of experience, you lose a lot of continuity, which I think becomes a bigger question when we look at the issues that our military has been grappling with and not being able to deal with. We talked last week about what it takes to be an NSA. I talked about doctrine. I talked about frameworks. These are things that are built over time, having a professional army. And I just think that there needs to be some questions around, you know, the why, and then what are the objectives that have been set. I just don't think I've heard enough of that to be excited about what has been done.
Thank you, Phoenix. So I think you've raised some important points, but I suppose the first question Nigerians would ask is, wasn't it obvious that the previous chiefs needed to go because under Buhari, they had not delivered? The country was not less secure, it was more insecure. They had failed in their duties to secure our borders. So the question is, what would be the argument for keeping them in the first place, Phoenix?
I think for me, I mean, the failure for me always starts with the commander in chief. Because for me, I mean, these guys, if there's any establishment, any institution that follows orders, it's the military, right? And so not to absolve them, because that's why you have senior military leaders, but there must be, I think the buck stops at the commander-in-chief's table. So now when there's a change in commander-in-chief, for somebody who's new, coming in from the outside, who was not privy to security briefings, who was not, you know, aware to a certain degree, for me, there is I would take a period of adjustment, set new objectives, set new KPIs for these same people, and see if they were the problem, or it was the guy that was giving them the orders that was the problem. Because again, back to the point I'm making, you lose a lot of continuity with the change that happens, and with a lot of, you know, the brain trust in the military gets retired. So coming in fresh from the outside, I would say, you know, new sheriff in town, hear what they have to say, hear what their viewpoints are, give them a new sense of direction, a new charge, set very clear targets for them, 3 months, 6 months, I want to see so and so done. If it's not done, then you change. Because then you can convince the Nigerian public that yes, this is what you asked them to do, and they clearly showed a lack of capability, and so you step, and so you change them. I was one who quite rightly, in my view, castigated Buhari and the previous, you know, service chiefs before this set that has just been retired, the Buratai class. I thought they stayed for too long. There was clear evidence of failure, of lack of capability, but he kept them on for too long, finally changed them. We all know all the drama around, you know, them becoming ambassador designate, but I won't veer off on another course. These new guys came in and, you know, they've been doing their thing. We've had similar problems, you know, persist. But I believe that with a change of commander-in-chief, with somebody new coming in, what you do is at least you give yourself some time, I mean, to make sure you fully understand the scenario, you know, test them and then make the switch. But again, at the end of the day, it's his call. He's done it, but I would like more intellectual rigor in the process, in saying this is why, and these are the targets I've set for myself, and this is what we want to achieve with these new guys. This is what I've set them to do over this time frame.
Thank you, Phoenix. The other question that keeps coming up, and it's something that probably needs further analysis, is on the question of ethnic balancing. Because when people, or when you look back before Buhari, you had Jonathan, you had Obasanjo, and you had Yar'Adua. So with Obasanjo and Jonathan, for example, Jonathan appointed his chief of army staff from the southeast, even though he was from what we call the south south. So his chief of army staff was an Igbo man, Major General Ihejirika. Obasanjo, on the other hand, his first chief of army staff was actually from the middle belt. That was Victor Malu. And then he went to Ogomudia, who was from the south south. From Ogomudia, I think it went to Oyazazi, who was also from the south south. So Obasanjo actually never had a chief of army staff who was Yoruba like him. And the question people are asking is that when you look at the composition of Bola Tinubu's own appointments, so the chief of army staff, Major General Lagbaja, is a Yoruba man. The commander, the new commander of the Brigade of Guards is Colonel Onosonya, who is also Yoruba. And the aides de camp, the ADC to the president, his name escapes me, he's also Yoruba. And a number of the key presidential guard appointments in Abuja have all been given to Yoruba officers. And a number of people have asked, is this an anomaly? Or if this is not an anomaly, why is it okay for you to appoint members of your ethnic group to all the key strategic positions around a president? Felix.
I think if we're looking at the broader positions, yes, it is an anomaly. I mean, you'd expect that there would be a broader view around the appointments. Now, when I spoke earlier, I was talking primarily about the service chiefs, and I mean, no one will argue that there's the right level of balance. But when you start looking at the broader appointments, and particularly those appointments that you called out, if we look at them strategically, those roles are very key to securing Abuja and the seat of power. And so what it clearly suggests or signals is that this is someone who is concerned about regime security for whatever reason. Now, we know all the fables and stories that were flying about prior to him being sworn in and all of that. So maybe the man took those stories to heart and decided that it's people that are like him that he wants in his place, you know, early on. But I think this is something that is not good. And for me, it is something that I totally disagree with. In the same vein that I called out Buhari for his sectionalism, and that was the precedent. It was Buhari, you know, doing the same thing. And now we're seeing Tinubu doing this, and this is what we said will happen. And therefore, in the same vein, calling out Tinubu for doing that and making sure that this is not something that he can do quietly and get away with. For me, it is very important that our diversity be recognized and protected, because we have such a tenuous union. And given what has gone on in the last 8 years under this APC party and their penchant for divisiveness and all those kind of things, I mean, for me, it's heightened the sense that we need to pursue inclusion rather than some of the things that we're seeing. But it's no surprise when you think about the ticket Tinubu himself ran on, a Muslim ticket, you think about all the things that he'd done. So one would not be surprised that he would toe this line. And it just goes to show, you know, the concerns that one has around where this set of politicians are taking this country. And we're already seeing it spilling over into the public space, where even when you go on Twitter, you see the kind of exchanges. It's very clear that our ethnic divisions have become heightened and in some cases weaponized. And these kinds of things that he is doing at that level only serve to exacerbate the issue. So it's one to call out, absolutely, and it's one to hold him accountable for.
Thank you, Phoenix. Because from my perspective, I still don't understand because the first person who seemed to attempt this idea of a fully pan-Nigerian security team was Aguyi Iransi. And he ended his assassination. He surrounded himself with mainly Middle Belt and core Northern officers because he was trying to prove that he was a Nigerian ruler for everybody. And I think after his assassination, future leaders of Nigeria became a bit suspicious or wary of filling your security team with members of your own ethnic group. Although in a weird way, it backfired with Yakubu Gowon because Yakubu Gowon's Brigade of Guards was made up of people from mainly Plateau State, where he's from. In fact, his commander of Brigade of Guards, I think it was Major General Joe Garba, was actually his in-law as well. Yet it was Joe Garba that led the coup alongside Murtala to overthrow Gowon. So Obasanjo, on the other hand, if I recall correctly, the commander of the Guards Brigade under Obasanjo was a Yoruba man because Obasanjo needed same thing to be able to trust that somebody from his ethnic group was in charge of his overall security. But Obasanjo balanced that by having an aide-de-camp who wasn't Yoruba like him. He had other key members of his team who were from different ethnic groups. For as I said, his chief of army staff was never a Yoruba man. They were Middle Belters or Southerners, but never Yoruba. So that sort of gave a balance. So I think where Tinubu may have dropped the ball is that both his army chief, his aide-de-camp, and almost all the key personal security roles have been given to solely Yorubas when he should have perhaps mixed them up. So, but as you said, this is something that Buhari started and Tinubu is just carrying on from there. But to my next question on this issue of the service chiefs then is, what are your KPIs for them, Phoenix? How would you say they have performed in their roles? Because a number of commentators have made the point that are we even putting too much on the plates of the service chiefs? What should the police be doing? What should the security, the intelligence agencies be doing? Is this war against terrorism actually the job of the army, Phoenix? Phoenix, are you there? I think we've lost connection. Phoenix, I think you're on mute. Are you trying to speak? Phoenix, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you now. Oh, I thought we lost you.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't hear the question. There was some technical thing that...
Sorry, I was saying, what are the KPIs you would issue to the service chiefs? Because there's the question, or there's the issue a number of commentators have made, which is the fact that we seem to be passing on to the military roles that should perhaps be performed by the police or the state security services, and not necessarily the army. So what is your expectation of the military? How would you decide if they've performed, the service chiefs have performed in their roles?
Well, I think it's a great question. And it goes back to some of the comments I've made over time. And I think I repeated part of it here last week when we were discussing the NSA. I think I even discussed this maybe a few months ago or something. For me, there's been an issue of, there needs to be an overhaul of our security architecture from a perspective of how we approach security. I think people who say that we're ascribing police roles to the military are spot on. And this has been something that I've been vehemently, against and calling out for a long time, particularly when we saw under Buhari all of this operation, Python dance, this one, that one, and all those kinds of things. I think there needs to be a sit down and a clear delineation of roles between what is the military supposed to do, and what is the police supposed to do? But it also brings the issue of what are we doing with our police? I am a firm believer in the need for state police. And so for us to be able to rebalance security and to set the right KPIs for the people, you also have to set the right organizational structure for your entire security architecture. You cannot have what we have today with a limited police force of less than 400,000 people, centrally managed and ill-equipped, ill-trained, and of course with the security crisis that we have all over the country today, and not expect that there will be a need to have the military support and augment them. So you need to fix your police force. Ramp up, you know, men, equipment, materials, doctrine, and all of that. And then make sure that your military are then forced to focus on external threats and, you know, high-level threats to the country. So you then define for them very clearly their areas in which they need to operate and what the rules of engagement for them should be. It's become so blurred because, again, back to the point that people are making, that you've brought them into civilian spaces, you've brought them into policing, and so you've blurred the lines in terms of what they should do, and that's why we see all of the noise nonsense that we're seeing. So there needs to be, first of all, a change in the framework in how we operate and a focus on rebuilding the police, decentralizing it, and then enabling state police. Of course, it means that you need a long transition time because, of course, the change won't happen overnight. But in doing that, you are then able to set the right, KPIs and metrics for the security chiefs to say to them, okay, you are now only supposed to be focused on these kinds of threats. And so I give you X number of months to make sure that, you know, banditry or eye swap or whatever, those kinds of threats are, you know, stopped at a certain level. I think that's number one. Number two for me is whether it be through Defense Intelligence or NIA or DSS, it now begins to sound to me like we have too many agencies and everybody just running around. There's no coordination, which should be the job of your NSA. Nigeria's intelligence, you know, architecture, our framework around how we gather information, how we analyze information, how we use intelligence to drive the tackling of threats and insecurity has to be ramped up to a high degree. And that was why last week I was saying, I'm not so sure that this new Ribadu guy is the guy we need for the issues that we have today, but the jury's out. Let's see if I'm wrong. But we need to ramp up that part of things because that then enables your security forces to operate in a targeted, in a well-defined and coherent manner. Because what's happening today is that we're typically going with brute force or, you know, just, you know, responding. What you do with a strong intelligence architecture is you're no longer responding, you're proactive. Because it's either you are creating situations that enable you to win, or you are gathering that intelligence to make you able to defend your territory more successfully. I don't see enough of that today. There's not enough coordination. And so for me, those are the areas that they need to look at. So when you ask me what KPIs, of course, there'll be interim KPIs given the structure that we have today. You know, professionalize your outfits, make sure your men and women of your forces are well trained, they're equipped. I mean, given the budget we're providing, make sure that we're spending the money well and make sure that the areas where we've identified threats, we're managing and maintaining them. But the bigger issue for me is you need to restructure everything so that we have the right, you know, organizations in place for us to truly be able to be successful. So all the half measures will not get us anywhere.
Thank you, Phoenix. Now on to our second topic, or the next topic, which is Emefiele and President Bola Tinubu. It has been reported in the news that on his trip to France, he said, under the leadership of Godwin Emefiele, Nigeria's financial system was rotten. Now, Phoenix, the first question is, and this is something a number of Nigerians have asked, which is, what is this new phenomenon where everybody seems to be blaming Godwin Emefiele for all the failures of the Buhari administration? Is this the right approach, or is there something we're missing?
Well, Emefiele gets no sympathy from me. I mean, he put his head out there, and so if he gets lopped off, that's his fair game. I mean, he overdid himself, and he deserves everything that is coming in his way. But I fully agree that this idea that, you know, you choose one scapegoat and that's it, is not going to hold water. I mean, Emefiele was, if anything, a yes man to the nth degree. Everyone knew that, yes, there was always a taskmaster that, you know, yanked his strings. This was a central bank governor who was very comfortable to ascribe the things that he was doing to the president. And the president was always comfortable to come out and confirm that these were things that he had ordered. So to say that, you know, the economy under Emefiele was disastrous is only telling half the truth. So yes, he had a key role as the head of the central bank, but it was clear that he was taking orders. So as far as I'm concerned, when I read the comment, I first thought about it as, is it the first arrow across Buhari's bow and brow that Tinubu is firing? I mean, should we be prepared for more to come? Like, is he actually going to take Buhari on and, you know, rubbish his legacy and make sure that he's held accountable for the absolute disaster that we had from an economic management perspective? The interesting thing was that the comment was also focused on financial sector, which was also true. I mean, we know that, you know, things were in very dire straits. We saw the nonsense that was the FX management policy. We saw all of the knee-jerk responses on, you know, through monetary policy that practically paid no dividend. They kept, you know, all they were doing was tightening from an MPC perspective. But at the same time, you were busy printing 22, 23 trillion naira for the federal government. So on the one hand, you were squeezing private enterprise. So it was just a very horrible time under Emefiele. So there's no lie there, but he's only telling half the truth. The whole truth must bring in Muhammadu Buhari, who was clearly the puppet master behind Emefiele and all of the things, and he must never be spared for what he put Nigerians through.
Thank you, Phoenix. But there's the other question, which is the fact that on numerous occasions, President Buhari came on air and confirmed that everything Emefiele was doing was based on his instructions. And secondly, Bola Tinubu himself campaigned on the record of Muhammadu Buhari and said he never once said he was in disagreement with any of the policies Buhari was pursuing. So how is it possible that literally less than a few weeks after Buhari leaves office, he's now reversing Buhari's policies, and whilst not blaming Buhari, seems to be blaming Emefiele when Buhari himself said he gave those instructions? How do we reconcile these perceived inconsistencies?
Well, to be fair to the man, he did complain about the Naira redesign, right? Of course, we know that it wasn't for altruistic reasons. He truly believed that Naira redesign was detrimental to his becoming president, and he voiced his dissension very clearly. And so, I mean, one can say, yes, it was towards the end, but at least you can point to that. But you're right. I mean, he did run on Buhari's record. He did publicly say that he will continue the things that Buhari was doing. So he can't do, and that's what I would not let him do. He is from the APC. He is benefiting from Buhari's 8 year in power. So he is an APC president. He was the APC national leader while Buhari was president. He cannot divorce himself from the goings on. And so, I mean, all that he's doing now, while they, like I said last week, are good steps, even though they're not being done with a lot of thought being put behind it, there's no clear plan. But he is part and parcel of this whole matter. And so for me, I mean, I really don't care if he goes after Buhari or not, but obviously he is going after Emefiele and he's asking us to fill in the blanks ourselves. But he's part and parcel of the whole story. He is. So, I mean, let's see if in the time that he's there, he makes an attempt to fix the nonsense that they've created.
Well, then I suppose, what is the end game finish? Because Emefiele is suspended. And as far as I'm aware, the only way to get him removed from office is if he resigns himself or he gets the Senate to pass it. I think it's a two-thirds vote saying Emefiele should be removed. So in your view, how do you think this is going to end?
I suspect they'll get him to resign. The interesting thing for me is he's being held by the DSS. Because we do know that there were some stories about him funding terrorist activity and all of that conversation, which is quite strange to me. But I suspect that what will happen is that there will be some arrangement where he resigns, and then they're able to fill the role with somebody else. But obviously, I mean, they probably are still in negotiations. You obviously want a deal for that to happen. I think it would be onerous for them to go into the National Assembly to get two-thirds. We do know that the National Assembly looks quite different in this current dispensation because of the inroads that were made into APC's majority. So I think, if I remember, they barely have a majority in the House. They won't get the 70 or 69 seats, 69 votes, without getting some of the other parties to come on board. So that's likely to be a challenge for them to get to do it that way. So I'm sure that it will be via a resignation, but it will be based on whatever they believe they have on him and getting him to resign.
That's going to be interesting. And then what happens if he refuses to resign? Are you saying you don't think he has the backbone to stand up to Tinubu?
I don't think it's an issue of backbone. I think he's going to want to get a deal that lets him get off lightly. And I also don't think that that Tinubu would also go all out in the sense that we have to truly finish this guy. So there's going to be a conversation at some point. The fact that he hasn't even resigned up to now tells you that there's clearly something going on in terms of trying to work out a deal or work out something. You don't get to be central bank governor and not have your own, I always like this word, compromise on people, right? He must have his own form of protection. And there will be conversations going on in terms of how this plays out and how everybody, you know, gets something out of it that enables them move forward. So let's see what, I don't think it's a backbone issue. I think it's more of, you know, who has what and who is able to have a conversation, which is why for me, you know, the fact that he's with DSS is the interesting point. You know, this was the CBN governor. At best, you would have expected that it would be the EFCC who will be chasing him if there's something that he has done financially. But, you know, using the DSS gives them room to be shadowy and, you know, hide him away and, you know, lean on him and do all sorts of stuff. But at the end of the day, there needs to be a conversation to sort this out.
And then in terms of his successors, I know Mr. Wale Edun has been appointed special advisor to the president on monetary policy. Some people said that that is just a stopgap appointment, that he is the person Bola Tinubu is hoping becomes the next central bank governor. In your view, do you think there's merit to those rumors? And how do you think his appointment will play with the international market or international investors?
I think there's a lot of strength to those rumors. I also think that, I mean, I've said this, that I think that it's a stopgap, you know, pending the resolution of the Emefiele issue. I'll be surprised if he doesn't then go on to be CBN governor. To your question about how will this play out in the international markets, he has the right pedigree. Given his knowledge of the financial markets, he would not be my choice. I think he's better suited to be finance minister. I think, like I've said before, for me, I prefer to have a policy wonk. I prefer to have somebody who has both theoretical and practical policymaking experience. He has neither. He's best known as an investment banker, a player in the financial markets. He was commissioner for finance under Tinubu in Lagos. So for me, the natural step for him will be to be minister for finance under Tinubu and help manage the economy, because that's really, we also have to be, you know, we've had things so mashed up that Nigeria has lost sense of how who has what role. The CBN governor is not responsible for running the economy. The CBN governor is responsible for managing monetary policy, for managing the financial markets, for managing the financial system, sorry, not even markets. Because you know, financial markets take an amorphous meaning, you know, when you have to also think about the SEC and all those kind of things. But because of how Emefiele operated, and you know, and the, of course, the incompetence of the immediate past finance minister and all of the issues that they had, people have come to see the CBN governor as somebody who should be running the economy or be involved. No. The finance minister for me holds, you know, more responsibility in that regard. And so, you know, having a Wale Edun do that, you know, makes more sense to me. I would rather have somebody who would return the central bank to its core function, its number one role of ensuring price stability and combating inflation, managing the financial system and ensuring stability, you know, driving those kinds of things. And what I would like to see would be somebody who's a proper economist, who understands policy, understands strategy, has both local and international experience at this level. You know, that would be my preference. So, but, you know, I would not be surprised if a Wale Edun is named to the role.
Thank you, Phoenix. It'd be interesting to see if this comes about, although it's possible that Bola Tinubu might choose a wild card, because people are already asking questions that his team is already a bit too centered around his ethnic group. So I think that there might be further noise if Wale Edun then becomes.
There's that question again. And you know, given again the diversity of the country that I was talking about earlier, people would also call out rightfully that you just had a southerner lead the central bank for 8 years, that perhaps it's time for it to go north again. So, and I remember last time we had Sheta here, he did mention Mansour Mukhtar, who given my criteria, would fit the bill. So there are others out there that I mean, that if he wants to cast his net wide, he can look to and ensure that there's balance indeed.
Thank you, Phoenix. Well, on to our third and final topic, which is Bola Tinubu's trip to France. He said he was there to attend a summit called A New Global Financing Pact. It was hosted by the French president, Emmanuel Macron. There was debate on social media as to exactly what he did there, because all the pictures of leaders giving speeches, he didn't seem to be to deliver any speeches. We saw the president of Zambia, whose speech people applauded. We saw pictures of other African leaders speaking, but Bola Tinubu seemed to be missing. So, Phoenix, what exactly was the point of this trip, and what did he achieve for Nigeria?
As far as I'm concerned, the trip was a cover for him to go back to Paris to take whatever medical care he's been going to Paris to take. So as far as I'm concerned, because I mean, you had this sort of meeting, which will have been his coming out party. This was his first major trip abroad since being sworn in. You know, you want to make a solid splash. You know, you just come into office, like the president of Nigeria, and then you end up being upstaged by the presidents of Zambia, presidents of Kenya, even old Cyril Ramaphosa was also, you know, speaking. So, and you're like, where's our guy? He's not speaking. And next thing you are finding out that is the ambassador who's speaking on behalf of Nigeria. So for me, as far as I'm concerned, it was just an opportunity for him to go to Paris, do whatever private stuff he had to do there, but also be able to show face and justify the trip. There was no, as far as I'm concerned, no benefit to Nigeria of him being there.
But I suppose the question is, what could Nigeria have gained anyway? Because a number of commentators have said, in terms of global influence, it's not quite France whose attention you want. You perhaps want maybe the US, China's. So really, what could he have achieved, even if he decided to participate, Felix?
But it was truly a global financing summit. It wasn't just Macron hosted it, but anybody who was anybody in the global space was there, especially from a financing perspective. Ajay Banga, the new World Bank president, was there. Georgieva of IMF was there. What's her name? Christine Lagarde was there. So, all other presidents, other heads of state, you are a new president, you're just coming into office, go make alliances, rub minds with people, let them have a perspective of you, let them know that there's a new sheriff in town for Nigeria, let them know that, okay, this guy has something, create that contrast to Buhari, because we know that nobody ever took Buhari serious. It was not there in intellectual terms to have projected a strong image for Nigeria. So that's what Nigeria would have gained. This is Nigeria. This is who we are. We are still the biggest country in Africa. We are the biggest economy in Africa. We started to roll back, all of the state restrictions that held us back, that created all the challenges for our economy. So if I'm at a global financing summit, I'm talking about the fact that now we're looking to collapse our, FX rates and let our central bank, operate in the right manner, which will be music to IMF and World Bank ears, explain how we're working around subsidies, taking subsidies off the table, opening up our economy, and the next steps that you potentially want to take, our debt issue, what are we going to be trying to do? So for me, and he without a doubt, he should have taken an opportunity to speak But the man doesn't have the capability. He doesn't have not. He doesn't have the. I mean, we saw him doing campaigns. We've seen him. You know, he doesn't have that lucidity for him to go to that kind of a forum and project the confidence and the stature that needed to be projected. So when you ask me what did Nigeria stand to gain, Nigeria stood to gain a lot, but we didn't get anything because of the person that leads us today. We've just moved from, I don't want to say frying pan to fire, but I mean, there's little difference between what we had under Buhari and the incoherence that we have under Tinubu.
Thank you, Felix. You've made an interesting point. So the question is it that Bola Tinubu is not intellectually capable of engaging these leaders? Because according to his CV, he trained as an accountant, worked for, I think it's Deloitte, and was also treasurer at Mobil. So these are internationally recognized companies. He's been governor of Lagos State. So it surely cannot be that he doesn't have the intellectual capacity to engage on the global level. So what is the issue? Why was he AWOL? He was there in the flesh, but didn't seem to be there in spirit. So your theory, is this correct? That it's his health? Is that what you're saying, Felix?
I believe it's his health. I mean, I believe it's the passage of time and the weakening of his body and to some extent his mind, have dulled him. And he's not as he was 15, 20 years ago. So when you say Tinubu's CV, from an intellectual perspective, he's not an intellectual giant by any means in my eyes. But if I'm comparing him to a Buhari, or even to a Jonathan, or Yadu, if I look at Tinubu, you know, when he was governor, and you know, some of his thinking and some of the things that he accomplished, I would definitely put him way ahead of Buhari. I would put him ahead of a Jonathan and those kind of guys in terms of potential intellectual capability. But there was always the fact that there were questionable things. So yes, he understood certain concepts, but he also had questionable thinking around certain things. For example, his fixation on interest rates and lowering of interest rates, and his fixation on debt, using debt to practically solve any problem. You know, at some point, I mean, he was pro printing money and some of those kind of things, but at least he could have a conversation, even though he ended up most times, in my view, on the wrong side of the argument. But I think with the passage of time and his health, he's not as lucid as he can be. And so having an extended conversation is beyond him. We've seen him at Chatham House. We've seen him at the NESG where he was, you know, farming out to other people. Basically, what he's hanging his hat on now is, I can identify people who can do this intellectual heavy lifting, and all I just have to do is just be the figurehead who is able to, you know, follow along in terms of what the overall direction and strategy is. Oh, we are removing subsidy. Yeah, but what's the plan? Oh, we're collapsing interest rates. Okay, then what happens next? Jige, you collapsed interest rates, but we still have 41 items banned. That's policy incoherence. So what exactly are you celebrating? So for me, I mean, in times past, 20 years ago, yes, I would say, you could sit in a room and have a conversation. It won't always be right. But today, given what we've seen of him over the last year, I would be shocked if he could hold his own in such a room, especially because you would be able to contrast him against other people. Imagine if he had gone to give a speech and then people were playing his speech versus I forget how to pronounce his name now, WH, the president of Zambia. You know, just imagine the contrast. So that's the kind of thing that his handlers try to avoid, and don't let him do any of those kind of things. So it will be interesting. I mean, if he does survive, you know, the tribunal and all of the court cases, we'll be interested to see how he manages to get by a 4-year presidency and not have to do some of these high level engagements.
Thank you, Vinny. This is interesting. And I suppose the follow-up question then is, why France? Because he seems to keep going there for his medical treatment, but one would expect that Nigeria being a former British colony, our leaders would prefer to go to London or even the US for treatment. But what is his fixation with France, Phoenix?
I've also been intrigued by France, but because what I'm intrigued is this. This is somebody who clearly spent a considerable amount of time of his time in the US. You know, we all know his history of, you know, having gone to school in the US, worked in the US before coming back to Nigeria to work for Mobil. We also know that, I mean, when Abacha was hunting down all the Nadeco people, he ran to the US and was there in exile. So you would expect that there's a bigger connection for him in the US from a private perspective. We also know that he has children in the US. So, we know that he had a major trip to France from a healthcare perspective, which suggests to me that this has been an ongoing thing over time that he has built, you know, like a base in France for his health issues. And it's always been intriguing to me as to how that came about. And why not the US? Why France? I mean, he's not a French speaker as far as I know. He didn't live there in the past. But then I remember this picture that we saw on social media at one point where he was having a meal with the Chagouri brothers. We know that they are based in France. And we also know that, I mean, he's in cahoots with them. They're obviously the ones doing the Eco Atlantic Beach and all of that. So maybe that's where the connection is. Maybe that's how he finds France more comfortable for him and all of that. And you never can tell. I mean, there could also be a relationship with Macron, you know. So a lot of these things, it's interesting, you know, for us to see. I mean, when I saw a post of him, you know, attending the banquet, you could see that there was a very familiar from the pictures. I mean, if you see the pictures of him being received by Macron at that banquet, this global financing summit, it seemed like there's some rapport there, there's some connection there. So maybe again, maybe that's also part of the story, which of course brings its own concerns, as we know that France is always interested in this part of the world. We're surrounded by Francophone countries, and they've always looked to Nigeria with beady eyes. So it's interesting. It's interesting, but apart from all of these different pointers, I've never truly understood the pivot to France and why. But like Buhari had his own, you know, London. London regular visits. It looks like Tinubu will have his own Paris regular visits. We wait to see how it all unfolds.
Thank you, Phoenix. It's interesting you've mentioned the relationship with the Chagouri brothers, because yes, they're the big investors in the Eco Atlantic process. I think they got into trouble because of some donations they made to the Clinton campaign. There's some sort of relationship there with the US. And the Chagouri brothers were also got into trouble as well because they were helping General Abacha launder his money. So it's very odd that Bola Tinubu, who apparently was fighting Abacha, is actually close friends with the main family that were helping Abacha launder his money. So it's very interesting love triangle there. But the other issue is his spokesman, his special advisor on communications, I think that's Dele Alake, announced that Bola Tinubu was leaving the summit and heading to London for a private visit. And this farewell trip was actually televised. He left on the presidential jet with all the paraphernalia of the Nigerian presidency to London for a private visit. What is happening there, Phoenix? What is this private visit? Do you know?
I have no idea. I've also been listening to the conspiracy theorists who say that London visit, that's the cocoa. That if we remember that, was it 2018 or 2017, when Buhari fell very ill and was away for a long time, it was to London that he went and came back anew. Man came back looking like he had shaved 10 years off his life, sprightly, looking very, very healthy, a very, very good turnaround. Now, perhaps there's some magic potion or magic healthcare service that is available to leaders of Nigeria that Tinubu can go get, and we may see a sprightly and a return to lucidity for Tinubu. So it was just an interesting take that I heard somebody make me laugh over the weekend. But you're right. I mean, you have a president who is announcing private visit to another country. It comes with all sorts of intrigue and ramifications. One, you are the president of one country. You can't, taking a private trip outside of your country is a misnomer. I mean, what is the private? Are you going to the beach or going on some holiday or something? So it's very interesting that they labeled it a private trip. And perhaps they're not yet used to the fact that he's a public figure. He is the president of the country. There are no private trips. You show up in another country, it is official business. If anything happens to you there, it's official Nigeria business. So let's see how they continue to spin this and what comes out of it.
Well, I suppose this, because this is the next question I was going to get clarity on, because I was looking at the commentary online and a number of people raised the points that, first of all, as you said, you're a public figure using the presidential jet and you're telling Nigerians that you're going on a private visit. But the annoyance that I was reading online was the fact that journalists just reported the press release without asking their own questions or providing any analysis. Because if this was the UK or the US, President Biden or Rishi Sunak cannot just announce, "Oh, I'm going to Japan on a private visit," end of story. The media would ask further questions. They would say, "Sorry, where are you going? What is happening there? What is this private issue?"
It's unheard of.
Well, why is that?
It's unheard of. You're absolutely right. I mean, what is a private visit? I mean, and to another, I mean, most of the times when we see presidents of other countries, I mean, of course they do take holidays, but they usually take holidays within their own country, because everything you do is subject to scrutiny. You land at, you cannot be a private citizen while you are president of a country. There's no private visit to somewhere else. You land, you're using the official paraphernalia, because they can't switch off your protection. You are the commander in chief. You're using the official jets. When you land, you're going to land under diplomatic channels and all those kinds of things. So it's a misnomer. It just doesn't make any sense. And to the point you're making around our press, it's the part that just frustrates and infuriates me, in the sense that we got dulled into this, press lethargy under Buhari, with this APC coming to power, because all of these journalists were just had either been bought or were in cahoots with the APC when a lot of them were in their previous guise as activists and all of those kinds of things. And you know, I don't want to say there's no curiosity. It's just they just kill the news. They just don't push. Only a few people ask the right questions. And this is a misnomer. I mean, you have a president who is barely 1 month into office and is taking a private visit. What is this private visit? Is there anybody discussing or debating the impact on Nigeria? What does it mean for you to show up in the UK as on a private visit? You know, if you are doing private things, are you being spied upon? How does it reflect on Nigeria? Those kinds of things. I mean, it's ridiculous that we're not having our own journalists deem this something that needs to be questioned, challenged, and make sure that the right thing is being done. So it leaves us to do it, and I'm glad that you're asking the question. Absolutely, no sense to me.
Thank you, Phoenix.
We know that we have a president who clearly has health challenges. You begin to look at the likes of Paul Biya. You look at the likes of what's this guy's name this other president in, is it Gabon or somewhere? You know,
Omar Bongo.
Bongo, all these old guys who are infirm, who are ruling, that's the kind of thing that comes to my mind. They are the kinds of guys who are practically living outside of their home country on private visits.
No, thank you, Phoenix. It's hopefully we can get the editor of one of the papers sometime on this podcast to explain to us, because it's something I've often wondered, because I read some headlines and I'm thinking, let's set aside the public for a few seconds. Even you as the journalist, don't you want to know the answers to this question? How can the president tell you he's going somewhere on a private visit and you just say, okay, you just report it without thinking, where are you going? What is happening? So I find it strange that a lot of our newspapers don't seem to probe the press releases that are issued from the presidency. They just report them as matter of fact. But anyway,
and these are the same guys who lost the opportunity. You know, remember that we used to have presidential media sessions. You know, I think was it quarterly or whatever that Jonathan used to do back then. And then Buhari did maybe the first or second one, and then for 8 years, maybe did only one other one. And there wasn't outrage, there wasn't pushback, there wasn't challenge to say, look, that was the one place where we had an opportunity to question the leader. I wait to see if we're going to have any of that with a Tinubu presidency. But that's how they lost their footing as the fourth estate of the realm, because that lack of challenge and that getting in bed with politicians robbed a lot of our journalists and media organizations of the opportunity to hold them to account and challenge on things like this. And when you let the small things go, it becomes harder for you, because you will have built that process.
No, thank you, Phoenix. You've raised some important points, and hopefully someday, hopefully we get a newspaper editor on the podcast to talk to us and perhaps explain what is going on. But our time is up. So first of all, thank you, Phoenix, for joining me on today's session. But last but not least, thank you to our listeners for always giving us helpful feedback and for staying loyal to the cause. But until same time next week, I say have a fantastic 7 day to everyone.
Thank you, Michael. Great chatting again today. And thank you, listeners. Have a great week ahead.